Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is December 15th, 2016. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. You can follow me on Twitter at jpodhoretz. You can like us on Facebook at Commentary. You can follow us on Twitter at Commentary. Manning the console as our producer and co-host, Noah Rothman, assistant online editor, who's on Twitter at Noah C. Rothman, and Abe Greenwald, our senior editor, on Twitter at Abe Greenwald. If we sound a little different to you, it's because we are recording from our spanking new sound studio here high atop the Garment Center, which was built by putting a wall up in the middle of my office and adding $600 worth of acoustical panels to see if we could avoid the constant traffic down 7th Avenue interrupting us and distracting us and forcing us to make bad cuts in our recordings when we send them out to you. So if you like the sound, let us know. If you hear anything that you think could be improved and you're an audio engineer, let us know. Come by and consult with us for free and fix everything for nothing. Of course, the story of the week thus far is the focus on the question of the Russian intelligence role in the 2016 elections. Big stories in the New York Times and on NBC News stating very flatly that the Soviet military intelligence and then other aspects of Soviet intelligence did, in fact, directly compromise the Democratic Party in the form of the Democratic National Committee's emails and the emails of John Podesta, the chairman of the Clinton campaign, NBC alleging that this was an operation authorized and run by Vladimir Putin himself. Abe Greenwald, you and I have read these stories very closely, and we are surprisingly, for people who I think would count as sort of anti-Russia Putin hawks, we are awash in a certain degree of skepticism, I would say. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. And I think it's a very important point to make that you can continue to think that Russia probably did hack into various institutions this past year and probably for many years before that, and to think that this represents a genuine threat to us. And to want to do something about it while also thinking that the recent spate of stories after the election are thin in terms of reporting. Basically, what a lot of these stories amount to is getting anonymous quotes from intelligence experts and some private firms saying things like, an operation like this couldn't have been done without Putin's authorization. Or saying things like, it is widely believed that the group whose fingerprints are believed to have been found all over this is one step away from the Russian regime. This is thin.
Now I'm going to play
Rothman.
I will play devil's advocate here slightly. Insofar as, while that reporting is thin, it is not as though it's not buttressed by the assessments of members of the Obama administration in positions of authority to know certain things like this. In October, we had a joint statement released by the Departments of Homeland Security and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence jointly saying that, quote, senior most officials, unquote, in Moscow were likely responsible for hacks directed against the Democratic National Committee, Democratic campaign committees at a lower level, and the, as we later learned, the personal emails of John Podesta, who is the Clinton campaign chairman. So we do have, and the Obama administration, we know now from reporting, was aware of this at around June, at the time when we started to see these things leak out in WikiLeaks. That is perfectly consistent with what we knew at the time and consistent with what we knew from the statement, which, by the way, they released in order to sate the desires of ranking members of the House and Senate Intelligence Committee, Dianne Feinstein and Adam Schiff, respectively, saying that we need to see something from the White House confirming what we already know to be Russian interference in the election.
But I mean, I sort of think that's kind of the point, that if this has more or less been known since June, why are we now getting these stories that are sort of
very
being
breathless.
Built?
Like, they're very breathless. Yeah. They are structured to make the case that there is new and renewed information that suggests that the Russians did this, and that the materials seem to have had a deep effect on the election. So there are two things to be said about this, one of which is that the stories prove in no way, shape, or form that these hacks did in fact change a single vote, result in the distraction of the Clinton campaign such that it made terrible mistakes that it would not otherwise have made in the last weeks to basically seed, without knowing it, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, and Wisconsin to the Trump campaign. And that the behavior of the Obama administration, the Obama White House in particular, is therefore extraordinarily puzzling. So the story says Obama knew in July about the hacks, and that they decided not to do anything about it. So why did they decide not to do anything about it? When they knew, as Abe said, that in 2014, for example, the Office of Personnel Management, basically the holder of all personnel records in the executive branch, had been hacked almost certainly by Russian military intelligence, the GRU, and that for the deep personal information of executive branch employees dating back 20 years, meaning their social security numbers, their bank account numbers, certain kinds of codes to transfer funds from OPM or from the government into people's bank accounts and other things were compromised. So if they knew that the Soviets were doing this, if they knew that the Soviets had hacked, why was there silence? Now, we have various theories about why there was silence, but I want to say that the startling factor here is that suddenly the Obama White House wants to claim that there was a crisis, that there's a crisis in the 2016 election provoked by the Russians. Why are they doing it now in the middle of December? They could have alerted the country to it in July or August or September or even October, when the DNI and the Director of National Intelligence said that, you know, the Russians were playing games. Where was the president here? Well, I think that you have to look at this in two ways, one of which is the president, having spent the first month after the election saying, Donald Trump is our next president. He was elected legitimately. I'm going to do everything I can in my power to help, you know, create a good transition and all of that, has decided that due to Democratic disaffection and liberal upset, that he is going to throw them a bone in the form of acting all panicked and hysterical about the Russian hack of the election and insist on a full intelligence report before he leaves office. The implicit charge being that after he leaves office, the Trump people cannot possibly be expected to release any such report, which may or may not be a fair assessment. So it's a political game that is now being ballasted by the media. As I said, I think we here at the table have no difficulty believing that the Russians and Putin wanted to play with our elections. The question is, were they effective? And I would say that there is no evidence that they were effective, at least from what we know about what they did. And and if there is culpability here in the United States, it isn't Donald Trump culpable because the Russians decided to intercede on his behalf. It is the Obama administration for failing to take the hacks seriously, for failing to respond to them, or for failing to make clear to the public how serious this was, because they thought Hillary was going to win and it wouldn't matter.
I would add that, and if there is no new information, which there seems not to be, hadn't we all said, and certainly hadn't liberals and Democrats been saying prior to election night that widespread talk of rigged elections and fixed elections is damaging and very bad for our democracy and for our image as a country, to suddenly flail off wildly and now start making this enormous case about it based, as far as we can tell, on no new compelling evidence, I think actually is dangerous.
Noah?
Well, the idea that the Obama administration didn't want to weigh in on this during the campaign for two reasons is consistent with CNN's reporting, Evan Perez over at CNN, who reports, one, that they thought Hillary was going to win and that it was ultimately self-defeating to give Donald Trump a reason to contest the results of an already decided election by suggesting that they had put their finger on the scales by weighing in and saying that the results of this election were delegitimized by foreign intervention. And I have my own theory that a lot of this has – the Obama administration in particular has been playing with Russia with kid gloves since it got into the White House, because it had a broader agenda, which was to ink an accord with Iran over its nuclear arrangement, and Russia was key to implementing that agenda. At the exact same time as this information was coming out, Russia was converting Fordo, a hardened underground enrichment facility, into something that was more civilian in nature, and it was importing low-enriched uranium from Iran. And, by the way, the Department of Energy has a deal with Iran to import heavy water, and Iran could just as easily turn around and provide that deal to Russia and give Russia a lot of money in the process. So those are some of the reasons why I think this administration was loath to dump all over Russia at the time, but those have sort of fallen away now.
Well, they've fallen away because they're leaving office. That's why it's fallen away, and because there is now a more pro-Putin person coming in than the person going out.
That is something I want to put to you guys, because I think a conspiratorially minded person could indulge in something that I'm about to. We're seeing a lot of leaks from the intelligence community that aren't really attributed to anybody in a senior level of position. They're making very serious allegations that aren't founded, according to the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, who says that I'm not seeing this sort of stuff that we're seeing in the press. We're seeing a lot of really, you know, hot-headed, serious allegations in the press from unnamed officials within the intelligence community that I can't back up with my briefings. So what is these senior officials in the intelligence community doing? Are they seeking to box in Donald Trump by forcing Barack Obama to make a move against Russia and therefore create the conditions that Donald Trump will have to either back away from this sort of position of his predecessor in a really, you know, in a way that he can't save face? Or are they trying to force his hand to get him into a much more confrontational position with Russia? I don't know if I land on that. I think it's probably a little too conspiratorial for me, but I can make a pretty convincing case to that effect.
Well, Noah, I would say this, which is that I think everybody who knows government and knows how government works and knows how the last 40 or 50 years have gone is a little baffled by the aggressiveness with which Donald Trump has responded to the intelligence community's words about the Russian involvement in the election, because the last thing you really want to do as president is get yourself crosswise of the intelligence community, not because the intelligence community is the thing that Hollywood claims it is, which is it's got its tentacles into everything and it'll cut off your credit card and, you know, do all these terrible things to you, but because it's a sieve and it sometimes has great ideological colorations, and if you get hostile to it, it just loves to leak to a whole bunch of people. For example, Bob Woodward, the most famous reporter in Washington, whose entire career is based on intelligence community leaks, and Bill Arkin, who is the author of the NBC News story I referenced earlier, who is a former intelligence officer himself, who tends to report on the intelligence community from the far left. So what we have here is, you know, Trump potentially antagonizing a force that can do him damage once he is president, rather than trying to make an ally out of it. Having said that, it is very striking that the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee says he does not know half as much about this as the New York Times and NBC News and others say they know, which is something to be skeptical about if he's being totally on the square. Now, I have to say for the third time that none of this is to say that this didn't happen. The question has to do with the effectiveness. It's a terrible thing, this hacking, the hacking of Podesta. It's a terrible thing. Everybody in America should understand it's a terrible thing. Podesta did not deserve to have his emails hacked. People were embarrassed. Neera Tanden, who's the head of the Center for American Progress, you may not like her. She's a liberal, and you may not like her, and she loves Hillary, and so you may not like her. But she tells a story in the New York Times about how she's walking into the headquarters of the Hillary campaign in Brooklyn, about to go to a meeting as a part of the transition committee, assuming Hillary wins, and how the transition's going to work. And she walks in, and there on a big screen in front of her is somebody reading an email that she sent to Podesta saying that Hillary's political skills were suboptimal. And she said it was like a punch to the gut. It was the worst day of my life. I've had this. This has haunted me every day since. She had some private exchange with a friend in which she spoke frankly about somebody who was, by the way, not even then yet a political candidate. And would never have wanted it to be public, would never have wanted this claim to be surfaced, with not something she would ever have said that anyone could have heard. Her property was stolen. She was embarrassed. There's no excuse for it. But that Neera Tanden said that Hillary Clinton's political skills were suboptimal did not change a single vote in Ohio. It did not affect the voting in Wisconsin and make sure that Donald Trump won by 3,000 votes in Wisconsin. Like that's where this all founders, in terms of the idea that it is helpful, I would say, that the American public be aware that we live in an age in which it is possible for foreign intelligence to start futzing around with our elections. That is a good thing for people to be aware of and to be concerned about. And if the Obama administration wants to do a serious report on this and release the evidence and the information to the extent that it can without compromising sources and methods and threatening people's lives, it should, so that people have a record of this and knowledge that this is what is happening. My great fear, as we look at this and we think about this OPM hack and various other things, is that we are living in essentially a pre 9/11 moment in which we are acting as though we are not putting ourselves at great risk with all of our financial information online, with everything that we have in total exposure, with the entire country sort of functioning through these virtual tubes and pipes, and that they can be toyed with, compromised. Everyone could suddenly find themselves 15-20% poorer with a really successful hack of the financial system. And until everybody is injured, as on 9/11, either thousands of people are directly destroyed financially, and then everybody feels vulnerable, we are not going to take the measures that are necessary as a country to harden ourselves against this threat. And that's the danger.
Well, one of those reports, I mean, everybody seems to have forgotten how heated the debate was over Russian intervention in the election during the election. We had this conversation.
You're the puppet. No, you're the puppet. Everyone remember that? That was the second debate.
Sure.
Hillary called Trump a puppet, and he called her a puppet.
The week before the election, we had a very disturbing NBC News report that indicated the United States was actively seeking to deter Russian intervention in the balloting process. If they were able to hack ballot boxes, which everybody said they weren't, but in the event that they were, the insurance policy, according to NBC News, was that officials said the United States is well positioned inside the Russian infrastructure, inside the power grid, inside their communications networks, their telecom networks, and we will shut the nation down in the event that there is a serious event inside the United States. And that would have been an act of
Obama. And Obama himself in September said people should remember that anything that they do to us, we can do to them right back and worse.
And that kind of deterrence model is the stuff that that has the capacity to become something much more conventional very quickly, because once you shut down a nation's power grid, you inflict such harm on them that it demands a response that doesn't necessarily have to be proportional.
And it's interesting how media uses intelligence when it suits their needs. Wouldn't it have been nice if the Washington Post, the New York Times, and NBC had treated the potential scandal when there were intelligence agents who were willing to come forth individually and say that the Obama administration was trying to cultivate intelligence on ISIS that showed progress and was playing down any intelligence that
made, showed that ISIS was on
that,
the
that
march.
Showed, that showed that ISIS was right. on the march. If when that happened, there were only days and days of breathless headlines about that massive.
Well, you know, that goes to another thing I write in a column in the New York Times today about what I call the underreaction doctrine. That is that the thing that unites Obama's decision to do nothing about the hack with Obama's decision to do nothing when the Russians invaded Crimea, with his decision to do nothing when the Iranians provoke us post-deal by, you know, boarding our ships in the sea and buzzing our ships in the Gulf and in the Indian Ocean, and we do nothing about Syria crossing the red line. We do nothing after Libya falls into the sinkhole, pursuant to the Gaddafi, to the end of the Gaddafi regime that we were largely responsible for, and of course does nothing to support the Iranians who rose up in revolt when the 2009 election was stolen. That all of this I call the underreaction doctrine, that it is a deliberate and conscious policy of the Obama administration to face threats and dangers and potential adversaries by failing to react or refusing to react, and that domestically this is even more striking when you think about the refusal to acknowledge the homegrown threat of Islamic terrorism, from the Fort Hood shootings in 2009 to the Tsarnaev Boston Marathon bombing to the Omar Mateen bombing of the shoot up of the club in Orlando to the San Bernardino couple, and indeed to the failed pipe bomber. Well, 30 people were injured, but in New York City, and that this constant game of we don't know what motivated them, we'll never know, how can we possibly know, that all of this is about, the underreaction is about allowing the administration not to do things that it does not want to do, because the message that is being promulgated is that the United States is not going to confront bad actors unless it can do so with a drone, and it is looking to make deals with bad actors to the extent that it can rather than force their hands. Which brings us to the most horrible event of the week or of the year and maybe of the last 5 years, the final collapse of the rebels in Syria and the final siege of Aleppo, the last stronghold of the Syrian rebels, where unspeakable atrocities are currently going on so that the Assad regime can secure the city, barrel bombing, supposedly mass suicide so that women are not taken into rape camps, and the just complete and total destruction of a once beautiful city reduced to the most astounding, you know, late World War I rubble. All of this, of course, flowing directly from 2011 to 2016, when the United States time and again had a chance to intervene on behalf of the rebels, to do what it could to prevent these atrocities, and refused to do so. And there is the horrible irony that the person who spoke up this week as part of the United States government against the events in Syria was Samantha Power, our UN ambassador. Can you maybe give us some background on that?
Sure. So Samantha Power, the ambassador of the UN, she made an impassioned speech at the United Nations yesterday, detailing many of the things that John had just described. And eventually she came around to addressing the Assad regime, Russia, and Iran directly. And she said, and I quote, "Are you truly incapable of shame? Is there literally nothing that can shame you? Is there no act of barbarism against civilians, no execution of a child that gets under your skin, that just creeps you out a little bit? Is there nothing you will not lie about or justify?" These are the questions she posed to those perpetrating the horrors in Aleppo. The answer is, of course they are not shamed. Of course they are incapable of shame, which is precisely why we have the doctrine of the responsibility to protect, which Samantha Power champions, which says that member states of the United Nations should intervene in such cases because we have a responsibility to do so. If that is her doctrine, if that is the doctrine that she champions.
We should explain that she championed it in a book called The Problem from Hell, which made her reputation. She was a sort of graduate student, a freelance journalist. She wrote a book about the genocide in the Balkans. It was a huge success. She won the Pulitzer Prize, and she became the spokesman for this neo-humanitarian position that genocides, that it was the responsibility of the West, really in particular, but the UN, as she framed it, to protect endangered populations from genocides, because by definition, once they were possibly the subject of genocide, they had no defense that they could offer themselves. And that having seen genocide after genocide, the Holocaust, Armenian genocide, the Holocaust, the Pol Pot genocide, and then Rwanda, that and the effort to extirpate the Kosovo, the Bosnians, that this was the moral obligation of the 21st century. This is what made her reputation. It's what got her a job on Barack Obama's staff. It's what made her a National Security Council staffer, and it's what won her the position of ambassador to the UN. She's also a close friend of Obama's. So that is who Samantha Power is. She exists because of the doctrine of responsibility to protect, right?
Correct.
So Noah Rothman, the doctrine of responsibility. Oh,
well, I just want to add. So the point is that it is under this understanding, it is our shame at the moment that we should be reflecting on by her own moral guidelines.
Precisely, because of course they have no shame. That's not the game they're playing. They are not playing a moral game in Syria. They are not interested in the morality of the Assad is not interested in sort of balancing the morality of his role against the practical political needs he has. He is a power player. This is power politics. In pop culture terms, they're in Game of Thrones, and she's in nursery school trying to adjudicate issues of relative fairness. And it is a form of unilateral disarmament. And as you say, it's a form of unilateral disarmament that we're even talking to them in these terms. They do not deserve to be spoken to as though they are moral actors. They are immoral actors. They are amoral. They've been committing war crimes for 5 years, and at the point at which they're about to triumph, where their strategy will prove to work, where it turns out that genocide works, where it turns out that, you know, flooding, and what's more, flooding the West with refugees works, everything works. The destabilization of Western interests in the Middle East by Russia works. Assad will be in power forever now. Now Obama speaks through Samantha Power, and that this is the end, this is the way the administration should end. It's funny, I'm just remembering, not to give everybody a silly, you know, glance back at my own life, but the first issue of Commentary's redesign in April of 2009 featured a piece on responsibility to protect by Todd Lindbergh, who is a fellow at the Hoover Institution who has worked on these issues for 10 years. And it was about how, after great effort and long work, the UN had finally accepted R2P, as it's called, as a prevailing doctrine, how this had been negotiated painstakingly by the State Department through various international agencies and the African Union and this one and that one and the other one. And that this was a new way in which wars would be prevented and genocides would be prevented in the 21st century. And what's the difference between then and now? When Todd wrote the piece, The Barack Obama administration was literally in its fourth or fifth week, and now it is in its, you know, almost at the end of its eighth year, and it has allowed a genocide on its watch.
Yeah, and period. It's the final pronouncement of Obama's sort of test of what he always refers to as the global norms and the international system and how it should work. It's all failed very tragically.
I mean, there are no global norms. That's the point. There are no global norms because the assertion of global norms itself is a wish, not a reality. The only way there are global norms, like any norms, is if they are enforced. The only way there is laws, norms are laws. I mean, norms aren't laws. Norms are supposed to be behaviors that everybody simply adheres to because they're norms and you don't need laws to back them up. Well, it turns out that there are no international norms because there are 204 countries in the world and every country has its own interests and it reads its own interests in its own ways. And there are four or five or six countries in the world in which the moral frame in which they act plays a role in their foreign policy. And we are one of those four or five or six countries, and we have failed history. And history will record that the United States twice in the last 20 years, first in Rwanda and now here, failed and succeeded in one case, which was Bosnia, where Bill Clinton, having stood by while the Rwandan genocide took place, could not allow himself to stand by a second time. That he himself says that he, and it's now 15, 16 years later, 20 years after the Bosnian horror, the Rwandan horror, and Clinton still says that he loses sleep over it. I doubt Barack Obama is going to lose sleep over Syria. He just doesn't seem like the sort of... I don't think he's the sort of person who loses sleep over much of anything.
Well, it should be added also that a huge part of why we didn't act in Syria, not that we would have anyway, was to keep in place the Iran deal, was to work on the run-up to it and then to put it into effect because Assad and Iran are such close allies, and Obama didn't want to upset that. Meanwhile, so while the slaughter is happening in Aleppo, Tehran is once again flagrantly talking about violating the terms of the Iran deal and wanting to start up a nuclear submarine program.
But also Libya. Libya was the test run for R2P, where they had an opportunity to advance it. I was a grad student in April 2009, and I'm working on international relations theory, and it always struck me that R2P was a flawed doctrine advanced by individuals who are married to a liberal internationalist theory that would bog the United States down in places that it didn't have national interest. Europe had a lot of interests in Libya. The United States did not. Concrete interests. As opposed to Syria, where the United States had vast interests, geopolitical, strategic, and material. And we abdicated the responsibility to act there because, in my opinion, R2P is incompatible with any sort of American foreign policy when regime change is out of favor. You can't have R2P while also saying regime change isn't going to work, it's a failed doctrine, and we can't have that. You can't protect a population threatened by its regime while also saying the regime needs to remain in place. Ted Cruz got a lot of traction in the campaign because he said, look, Libya was a failed intervention. Interventionism is a bad idea. Interventionism failed in Libya, particularly because Barack Obama said explicitly, we're not going to change the regime there. We have no plan to change the regime there. And when the regime fell, there was no plan to do anything on the second day.
And perhaps the most notorious phrase probably of the relating to the foreign policy of the Obama administration was promulgated by an insider to Ryan Lizza in The New Yorker when he said that our policy in Libya is leading from behind. So we were not going to take the lead in Libya, but of course we have to. We're the most powerful country in the world. If we're involved, we lead. So we'll lead from behind. So how everything is going to function and how the war is going to be won in Libya and how Gaddafi is going to be taken down in Libya and what happens afterwards, that's really not our concern. But the most striking thing about this whole thing, and you're exactly right about R2P, makes no sense with a president who does not believe in intervention or regime change. is that nonetheless he put the person who created the doctrine at the United Nations, and she stood there. She's been working in this administration for 8 years, standing there. And any other self-respecting, I put it to you, any other self-respecting intellectual who saw the theory that she promulgated and the idea that she made popular and the policy that she is the author of basically run, dragged through the mud, discarded and shamed, would have quit years ago and made a passionate and powerful piece, you know, speech, not about how we have no shame from her comfortable apartment in the Waldorf Towers and her big desk at the UN, but somewhere where she could have done some damage to the administration, shamed it, and made it at least partially responsible for the policy that it was promulgating.
And something else, and this may be a bit of a digression.
And in Europe, any official would have done, any official of any parliamentary system would have resigned 5 years earlier, because it would have been shameful for such a person to walk through the halls of the parliament in which she or he served, because that's the system there, and have people say, oh, Samantha, well, how's that responsibility to protect going?
Well, huh? Yeah, if she were to resign, she'd basically be repudiating her life's work.
No, that's the whole point. If she doesn't resign, her life's work is repudiated, and she is complicit.
That's the judgment in the repudiation of her work. I don't know if she can see it from her position.
Well, if she can't, she's a fool, because there's nothing clearer. It's like you could have 21,000 vision and be able to see that that Samantha Power has been shamed and humiliated.
But another reason why this is flawed is the idea that there is such a thing as a moral foreign policy. I understand we come at it from that kind of logic and that framework and that language. But, I mean, say what you will about the flaws of democratic peace theory, and it is flawed in a lot of ways, but it's not a moral vision for the future. You're not talking – when you talk about regime change, you're not talking necessarily entirely from a moral framework. It is about very narrowly defined geostrategic interests. The democratic powers have an interest in not going to war with one another. Wars of choice are problematic, and they're to be avoided. And that's why you come at – you know, you have – a framework that says we need to promote democracies and we need to promote stability and we need to prevent genocide, not just because it's good for mankind, it is, but also because it gets us out of imbroglios that we don't want to get into.
Right. So the Obama administration, in your reckoning, and Abe has written very much at length about this, so the Obama administration removed all pillars of this. So we don't promote democracy. We don't do regime change. We don't fight wars of choice, and we stand aside while our enemies roll all over us.
When you put it like that.
So the astonishing thing is that we went from a foreign policy that was maybe excessively and misguidedly idealistic to a foreign policy of inaction and underreaction, and the results of one were unfortunate, and the results of the second are parlous beyond belief. We are now in a position in which there's going to be a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, in which, you know, we're about to potentially engage in a trade war with China, and in which Russia, a tin pot country with the 20th largest economy on earth, is running us ragged and running circles around us in the geopolitical, geostrategic game. It's got no business being anywhere in proximity to us.
And I think the question is, at the end of the day, and I'm not entirely certain of the answer, was Obama's reaction to the idealistic foreign policy itself also extraordinarily idealistic? In other words, so did we retract power and allow all these things to happen because he thought at the end of the day we're all going to get along, it's going to work out, we don't need to be the enforcer on the block, people are going to get along?
Know that it would be moral to do. I know you're not allowed to say this because people hate this term, particularly liberals hate this term, but it was moral to go on the apology tour. That's moral. It's moral to say we shouldn't have intervened in the Dominican Republic and Iran and Guatemala and Vietnam. That's the, you know, that we are the promoters of an original sin of interventionism that he was going to, from his perch as a 1982 foreign policy graduates, you know, foreign policy student at Columbia, learning about all the evils of American behavior over the previous 20, 25 years. He was going to correct it by going to the world and saying, gee, we did wrong. And what the world heard was, okay, I guess you're getting off the stage. It's every man for himself now. And what Vladimir Putin heard was, wow, I can reconstitute Novorossiya and push my interests forward and take a bite out of Ukraine and start asserting my primacy in the Middle East, in Syria and Iran and Iraq. And we stood there and let it happen.
And the results of this that could be really terrifying are that the American public has sort of lost its taste for maintaining its position in the geopolitical order. It looks around at the post-World War II order and says, what's it all for? What do we get out of this? You know, the benefits of global unfettered sea lanes and trade and, the fact that we haven't had a great power war in the last 50 years, sorry, 75 years, that's, you know, it seems intangible. And now we actually have a genuine Buchananite taking over the foreign policy apparatus who's going to retrench in some fashion or form. We don't know how much he can actually get away with, but he's going to do something.
I don't know what – I mean, the point is, I think, Noah, that it's not clear how much more retrenchment there can be. Let me put it to you this way. What less could we do in Syria than we have done now?
I'm not worried
about
it.
What less can we do against ISIS than we
have
done now?
What less can we do in Europe? What less can we do in Northeast
Asia?
Right.
Well, that's a different thing. So the retrenchment there, which I think is an interesting point.
That's what they mean. We're talking about international politics, geostrategy, great powers, not talking about non-state actors.
Right.
Non-state actors is the stuff that they want to combat. They want to really go hard after non-state actors. Drone warfare and the kind of stuff that Barack Obama aggressively prosecuted to the chagrin of his liberal left. Right. That stuff is going to ramp up. What we're not going to be doing is putting naval assets off the coast of China.
Okay, here's my hope, and we can end on this. My hope would be that upon assuming the mantle of the presidency of the United States, that Donald Trump, who is clearly somebody who is very much aware of relative status levels, who's up, who's down, who's got power, who doesn't, who you make a deal with, who you don't, who's the power in the deal and who's got the less power, is going to understand very quickly that as President of the United States, he is the most powerful man in the world, and that he doesn't have to take guff from Vladimir Putin, who is by rights, the 20th most powerful person in the world, not the most powerful person in the world. And that rather than finding some way to work with Putin, if Putin humiliates him, if Putin starts playing games with him, if the Iranians humiliate him and start playing games with him, he will have the reaction not of Barack Obama, which is, oh, maybe if I make nice, they'll be nice. But, hey, I'm the big guy here. You're going to listen to me. And that is the hope for the change.
But that's what I'm worried about, because he spent the entire campaign inviting testing, inviting Russia and Iran to test the parameters of what they can get away with.
Right.
He said, I'm not going to defend Estonia if you go after Estonia.
Right.
But he's going to have to. He's going to be under institutional pressures that he cannot avoid.
Right.
And
well,
in that case, we have a big miscalculation that could cascade.
Except here's the thing. We're in uncharted waters, and they'll test him, and we don't know how he's going to respond to the test. That's the simple fact of the matter. He could say whatever it was he wanted to say during the election, and when you're faced with a binary choice, go or don't go, act or don't act, look like you're weak or look like you're strong, how about that? Look like you're weak or look like you're strong. The Soviets, the Russians start moving on Estonia and you don't act. And then you look like the weak guy and not the strong guy.
If you don't have a face-saving way out of that.
And also it would be an extraordinary – I don't know if he can see it in such clear terms. It would be an extraordinary political gain for him if he actually, after all this, after all the talk of his collusion with Russia, decides to do something a little forward-leaning in the face of Russian
provocation.
Nobody
gains from a shooting war in Eastern Europe.
No, but you can, but I'm saying they move, they start rolling, and then you say, "Oh, whoa, wait a minute, there, buddy." Mr. Fourth Rate, you slow down there. I'm the president. You don't test me.
The genius.
Don't taunt me. Don't tempt me. Don't try to face me down. And that is the thing where the one thing that he said that was sophisticated and politically interesting about foreign policy. That he said during the campaign that everyone tut-tut and everything, which is, I think that there is an advantage in being unpredictable is really true. Ronald Reagan very much benefited from the idea that the world didn't entirely know whether he was the type of person who was going to take things to the next level. And that is true in power politics in general, and it's true in deal making. And if Trump is, in fact, the person who believes that he's the world's greatest deal maker, he'll understand this. And I understand that we've come to the end of another commentary podcast. Commentary Magazine, this is now in its 72nd year as the foremost intellectual, cultural, analytical monthly in the country. Please join us at commentarymagazine.com, where you get some free reads, and then we ask you to buy our $19.95 annual subscription or full access $29.95 subscription, which includes our beautiful monthly magazine delivered to your mailbox. Right now, we do have a special for listeners of the Commentary Podcast. If you go to our subscribe page at commentarymagazine.com and you enter the coupon code podcast, instead of $19.95 for our digital subscription, you will pay $14.95. And instead of $29.95 for our all-access subscription, you will pay $24.95. Dozens of people, dozens, I tell you. We're excited to take up this offer on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and the first podcast of the week. You join them. It's so exciting. You can read everything. Just sign in and you stay there. We got such good stuff. We got such good stuff coming up. We got a fantastic issue right in front of you right now. You want to learn about how Israel should change its strategy from maintenance of a grinding, cold, unceasing war with the Palestinians to a strategy of victory? You can read Daniel Pipes' piece on the subject. You can read Naomi Riley on the fiasco at the Standing Rock involving the Dakota Pipeline. Got a lot of other great stuff, and we got more great stuff coming up as we enter the age of Trump and efforts to delegitimize him and efforts to see that good policy rather than bad policy is the order of the day over the next 4 years. So for Noah Rothman and Abe Greenwald, I am John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.